Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Resource Cast. It's 2021. We are firmly in the second wave of the coronavirus crisis, and Lucas and I are getting together to chat about pandemic side hustles. Say hi, Lucas. How's it going?
Yeah, no, not too bad. Good. Had a nice little break. 2021 kind of hit the road running as well. Here's the thing with the hustles that it then never stopped. The freelance work, I wasn't that strict on myself to set boundaries, so I worked straight through, which was quite nice actually. So the kind of productivity never kind of lagged. It was like literally took breaks in order to have family time.
It's quite interesting. I kind of shut up shop on around the 21st or so, and took a break until the 4th. And at the time, right before I closed up, I didn't think I really needed a break. And I thought I was going to do some other work and work on some projects on the holiday and all that kind of thing. And I just didn't open my laptop for like 10 days straight. I really did feel the need for a break at the end of the year. And maybe it's this kind of societal pressure around you and everyone's taking a break and all that kind of thing. But yeah, I do feel much refreshed now. And by the end of last year, I was ready for a break, which is weird when you're freelancing.
Well, you also, if you think about it, you were getting your podcast off the ground, you're having a baby, you moved house. Life happened a hell of a lot, I think. And then also there was a pandemic.
And there was a pandemic, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's a lot of stress. It's good to take that break.
Yeah, it was a very, very big year for me and for you and for, I think, everyone. And I hope that everyone out there is kind of hanging in there right now. As I said, we're in the second wave. It is we're just going into 2021 right now, and it already seems like it's going to be kind of just as much of a screw up as last year was. But yeah, we're gathered here today to talk a little bit about pandemic side hustles. So we're going to have a conversation with Gabriele Gaba. He is a concept artist who's worked for many game development companies, and he currently runs a one-on-one art school online where he brings other concept artists up to speed on both the fundamentals and polishes their skills. And he's got 10 years of experience in the industry, and we're really, really excited to talk to someone who is in kind of like a parallel industry to, I think, the resources standard arty type people who would be art directors, designers, that kind of thing. I'm not sure how many game artists we have, but I think it's something that a lot of people are interested in. It's a fascinating industry. And welcome to the show, Gabriele Gaba.
Hey, welcome, guys. How's it going?
You can't welcome me. This is our show.
No, I'm used to welcoming other people, so that's what I say.
Right, because you run your own, like you do a vlog with interviewing
people,
right?
Yeah, I interview people sometimes. We're going to be ramping that up this year, so yeah.
That's amazing. You've way surpassed me. I had a look at it last night, and you've got infographics and all kinds of stuff. Like, it's rad.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's all on the budget. You know how it is.
Yeah. But I guess it's part of the – it's part of – what is the – okay, you know what? I'm going to ask you about that part of your business a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Let's chat a little bit about you first. So, you know, I've known Gabriele for a long time, and he's – what has always struck me about you is your passion and your dedication to your art, because there was a time when you disappeared for I don't know how many years, but I just didn't see you because you were training yourself. Like, you went into a – like, dude goes to Japan and stands under a waterfall and does karate for like a million years kind of thing. It was nuts. And you came back, and the level that your art went to between kind of being a fan artist, very much an amateur, to where you are now, like, is insane. Tell me about, or tell us a little bit about your journey as an artist.
Awesome. So first of all, it's interesting that you mentioned the whole standing under a waterfall thing, because for me, I chat to my students about this concept quite a lot. And the way I describe it to them is I kind of hearken it back to, and I hope some of your listeners understand this reference, but there's a Japanese anime called Dragon Ball Z. And in that show, Goku, who's the main protagonist, goes into what is essentially a science fiction gravity chamber. And in there, he trains under severe gravity conditions in order to improve his skill. And the interesting thing about it is it also delays time. So by the time he steps out, it's like 2 days later, And then he's become, you know, 10,000 times more powerful than the show. And then everybody around him kind of looks at him and goes like, oh, man, I can't believe you got so ridiculously powerful.
Lucas and I are nodding because we both know this reference, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're all nerds here.
I never got into Dragon Ball Z, funny enough. Right. I kind of know of when the overpowerness happens in the end. But I love that idea of cutting. It's already a cool creative solution to a montage. You know, like the guy needs to leave. Yes, no, it doesn't. You can only leave 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then it's still, it's rad. It's
yeah, we need a montage. We'll just slow down time. Exactly. That'll make it easy.
Yeah, just slow down time. Exactly. Explain it that way.
Yeah, so that's the basic idea of it, is that like I try to put my students through the same concept of like how much can you improve in the shortest amount of time? And to actually sit down with that and say like, what is it going to take? Like what can you do to actually do that? And so it is possible. And I think isolating yourself away from, you know, the insane amounts of dopamine addiction we have today. But, you know, in those days when I did that, I had to make a lot of sacrifices. And that's part of increasing your ability at anything. It's just really, how dedicated are you? Are you going to make sacrifices? And I wanted to go away with you guys when you would go to like all these amazing like trips together with friends and family and stuff. And I unfortunately, I had to make a choice. I was like, I could either be a broke ass artist for the rest of my life, or I could actually get really good and get to a place where I'm making decent money and like I can maybe help others in the future.
So what was your, I mean, also it was slightly easier back in that time because social media wasn't so pervasive at the time. There wasn't quite as much input as there is now.
So, you know what? I'm actually going to flip to my handy dandy reference here. So I started working in 2010. So I've been at this for over 10 years in the industry and working in video games primarily, but then in animation. But the journey, as you asked, John, let me answer your question, was a little bit unusual for a South African, because when I graduated a 3-year diploma at college for animation, I was expecting to enter the animation industry, and that didn't happen. What actually happened was I was contacted by a friend of mine who said, hey, there's this Canadian in Cape Town who wants to start a game company and he's looking for artists. Why don't you go apply and see what happens? So I thought, okay, I'm not even graduated yet. I was still in my 3rd year. Let me go find out what this is all about. And it turns out that before the economic crash of 2008, this guy was, hey, let's start up a company essentially and get that going. And then, you know, put that together with a Norwegian investor who gets benefits from investing in talent in South Africa. And together, the two of them put together this company called Web and Circus. And so a bunch of guys, myself included, entered at a very low level. And we started working on some of the first iPhone games. First, I should say, not only first iPhone games, but first 3D iPhone games. And so we were sort of cutting edge at that time for mobile gaming. And we came in quite new. We didn't know what we were doing. We just had this Canadian guy showing us around and showing us what to do. Shout out to Steve McIver, who gave us all the maple syrup. From there, the Norwegians eventually started to feel the crushing pressure of the economic recession. They pulled out of South Africa. And at that time, we had very little choice but to start our own thing. So Bossman decided to start his own company called Tasty Poison Games. And from there, we started developing a bunch of IPs. One was particularly successful. It was called Pocket RPG. And the profits of that game were shared equally between Bossman and the head programmer. And what's really interesting about that story is that head programmer decided to start his own company, and from that money, and he, as you may know, started Broforce and all those other games. And so Free Lives was born out of that, and that's the biggest game company in South Africa, was born out of that moment in time. So a lot was happening. It was kind of like watching, I don't know, the early days of id Software. I don't know if you guys have ever seen those documentaries where you see them talking about, like, you know, the early development and what it was like. And it was very much like that time, except maybe with less drugs. And we were, you know, really just trying stuff out and pushing to see what could South African game development look like. And everybody, even today, is still in that mode because it's still a fledgling industry. There's still a feeling of, you know, what can we produce? What's possible? And you still see people getting together over game jams, you know, every single year at UCT. Well, not obviously last year, but, you know, it has been happening, and a lot of indie development has been happening here. So South Africa is this really interesting place of high talent because we're like the Wild West. You know, every man for himself creates what I think are rock stars, like diamonds, right? We produce diamonds in South Africa. And then that's a double analogy there, but it's true. Like the artists that I know who are working overseas that are South African, they're all a way above average artists. They're really, really good at what they do because of this pressure of like having to succeed.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's quite a gauntlet to run here. And also funny enough to go and find ways of doing it. So yeah, the most we've got overseas. I can draw the parallels with South Africans abroad at the moment from an advertising point of view. Killing it, like absolutely killing it.
Yeah.
Quite amazing to find out in another industry that the same thing is happening.
Yeah, and I've actually been a part of a local company that was funded by advertising money. So, like, one investor was in advertising, and so he just took, you know, his winnings, I suppose, after many, many years, and he pulled together a little indie game company and tried to hit the mobile market in a big way. But, you know, that story is a whole other podcast, I think, just on that.
It's a bit of a crazy industry, and from the people that I've talked to in it, I get the impression that when it comes to developing mobile games, like, do you try to develop quite a few and hope that one hits, or do you put all your eggs in one basket? And because it feels like you've got a good chance of just getting nothing, just because you're not going to get someone's not going to see the game, you know, like there's so many games out there, but what if you spend 3 years developing something and no one ever sees it?
Yeah, it's not entirely unlike starting a fledgling business. You know, you're going to have that percentage of people who come in with really, really high hopes and naivety, and then just get completely crushed when they realize that they're part of the 90% that fails and can't make it to market. And you can try mitigate that with a lot of experience. That's what we did. We had obviously our boss man, Steve, who was really good. He had published before in Canada for bigger companies and things like that. So he had not only connections in terms of marketing and getting your game on the front page of journals, right? Gaming journals and things like that, but also having a savvy for knowing what will hit the market the hardest at what time. So he would look at the market before we developed a game. He would say, okay, this is saturated, that's saturated, but no one's doing something in this sector for these people. Why don't we hit that really hard and then we just do a great job? And his whole philosophy at that time was like, we don't have insane capital, so what we'll do is we'll just do a 3-month turnaround on every game. And so we would produce like 4 or 5 games a year for different clients or for ourselves and see how it hit the market. And sometimes you get a decent result, sometimes it fails miserably, or, you know, stuff happens. But I prefer this environment of trying minimal ideas and seeing how the market reacts to it. And I mean, that's the success of Free Lives. That's what they did. They went to a game jam, they developed Broforce in a weekend, in 2 days. They play tested it at the jam, and everybody was having such an amazing time. Everyone was crushing it with ideas for the game, all these things. And then they suddenly realized, guys, we've hit something really, really powerful here. What if we actually develop this? And I take my hat off to Evan, who put his money where his mouth was, took out loans and hired people and just got it done. And the rest is history, right? Like, they're multi-million company, right? So this kind of thing is you got to have almost a feel for it. You got to have the passion for it. I mean, people in the industry, you're either a developer or you're someone helping a developer, and you hope that the person you're helping has a great vision.
So on the software and app side, there's a minimum viable product. You try and make the most minimum thing, see if it works. If it doesn't work, then you've only wasted a fraction of the time that it would cost to develop a whole thing. And then if it hits, to develop it further. I'm seeing, if I can just steal a bit of thunder off the minimum viable product, even in the presentations to clients at the moment, I don't, like, when I'm presenting work, I present it in its most basic form, scan form, see if it hits, if it doesn't hit, even with their taste and the market, stuff like that. And kind of taking that minimum viable product philosophy and putting it into design. Don't get hectic about it. Because, like, you're not necessarily, you don't know the client's business, but the client knows their business. So your assumptions will get negated very quickly in meetings, and you would have wasted too much time. So it's almost like the least amount of work is the most productive work going forward.
So you're talking 3 to 4 months to develop a game, right? And obviously you're on the art side, so you're supporting those developers. And that must be, like, absolutely intense. Like, I look at your LinkedIn profile as well, and your kind of, your bio, the amount of different companies you've worked at, and obviously sometimes it's a project and then you're done and then you move on. But you've worked for quite a lot of different companies. And I know that you went through a phase as well where you just burnt out on the industry. Similar to the marketing advertising thing, a lot of pressure, short deadlines. Tell us a little bit about the pressures of working in game development.
It obviously depends on what project you're on. Not just video games, but you know, what I do can be seen as transferable to the animation industry and the film industry in different respects. In animation, it's called visual development. In video games, it's called concept art. And so it's also called that in film, right? But all three have a slight difference to them, but they all have that basic, you know, show up to work, start building out these art ideas so that other people can build it into assets. I'm trying to think. The turnaround on games is fast if you plan for it. If you don't have a plan, you're going to be in a bad place.
And is the South African landscape generally quite professional about that kind of planning, or have you been in a lot of kind of rinky-dink, no plan, no hope situations?
Well, it's actually the biggest issue is how green everybody is. It's the naivete of let's build the next Clash of Clans. I've been in that exact situation, and the perspective is completely out the window. It's like you're playing with millions of rands. We're talking about, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of rands that need to go into something like that with high talent. Part of producing a viable product in 3 months for a game, you know, for an advertising pitch, I can imagine you just pull like 3-4 people and you kind of brainstorm. I don't know. I'm obviously not experienced in that, but I have done storyboards for advertising. So I know there's like a short turnaround on like pitching something. And with a game, it's like you have to have the programmers on board, the artists on board, the 3D modelers on board, and the animators on board. I mean, we're talking about a team of 8 for 3 months on pretty good salary. Like, it's for a small indie company that's just kind of trying to put out a MVP. Like, that is pretty hectic in terms of pressure. So everybody's got to be on board. And it can be done. It can be done.
Financially, though, it must be quite a – it's a relatively risky investment, right? Because it can be quite hit or miss.
You want to get your investors in early. Right.
But if someone like the team behind Broforce, if they pitched a game to an investor, that investor could be fairly sure that they know what they're doing and it could be relatively successful.
Yeah, and the experience they have is we're not going to put anything in front of an investor we don't feel confident about. They're at that level where I've hung out with them and I've been around them and I've worked for them in the early days, and I know that Evan specifically is very particular about his IPs. He will actually develop side project IPs while other IPs are going, just to see if it's possible to develop them. And then if they're not, he'll nuke them. I've seen him nuke. I've been on projects with him where he's nuked them. Like, I worked on an early side scroller with him, a beat 'em up called Kiki Fighter, and that never went to market. And that would have been great. That's where we play as David Hasselhoff beating up bad guys. It's awesome.
Could have been a royalties issue.
But you know how they get around it, just changing
David Hasselhoff
consonants.
Absolutely.
Because that ratio of 90 to 10%, that 10% needs to be at such a quality. So it's, again, checking that everything's in place. The idea of risk when it comes to creative endeavors, what's your hit rate when you're going to invest in company? Your return isn't guaranteed either. So in the world of especially when you say investors and even investing in your own business, to go like, what do you want to do? Can you put your money in a retirement annuity, or do you want to go and see where this goes? You can go and invest, you can invest in property, and that can all mess out as well. So the risk is kind of like a relative. But when it comes to what you want to do, if you want to throw your money in the water on creative stuff, that's almost, to me, rather back yourself in those things. And also, do you like what you spend your money on? Again, like what is frivolous and what is rewarding? And I can only imagine how rewarding it would be to have a famous game out there and actually go like, this is something we made. And again, the compound effect of that is like, cool work attracts more cool work. So if you're doing something like Broforce, the Broforce stuff comes out, you go, okay, cool. That's now I've got some credibility and we can go keep doing this stuff. Like I said, it's that risk. That's more my point. The risk is that it's.
One of the things I noticed to speak to that is that one of the things I think that made Free Lives so successful is Evan's concept of what game development is. He broke it down to its bare minimum of what the market expected. So he said, okay, a game has to be fun and bonkers and like out there, right? So whenever I worked on something with him, he was like, add more blood, make more heads come off. Like he would just go like, go all the way, like bring it back to that, you know, 1990s video game aspect of like, it has to be fun, it has to be outrageous. And we want to upset people a little bit. And like, I think there is something to that where the market reacts so strongly when they see this stuff. It's like seeing, I don't know, celebrity shave their head. You know, it's like, I have to look at it. It'll have to be a part of this. Like, I just want to know what's happening. And as far as the 10% investment, I've recently, especially now that I'm doing my own thing with my own company, I almost feel like, you know, yes, you can take your money and you can pour it into whatever mutual fund or retirement annuity or property or whatever investment you decide to do. But at the end of the day, I still kind of am starting to lean towards this idea of the more you invest in yourself, the more return you're going to get on that. And that could be your business. That could be your skill set. It could be anything. But the more you put into yourself, you're going to make less mistakes moving forward. And you're probably going to generate a lot more income, whether it's your personal skill set or it's your business savvy.
Yeah. Everything is school fees.
Yeah.
If you're not winning at school fees, you've just learned something. It's not losing. It's the perspective of what failing is. And it's literally go, oh, yeah. Okay, lesson learned, move on. Thanks.
There is also something to be said for like when you hit gold, you know it's gold. Like there's something about like a sweet spot. When you hit something and like you get that feeling inside of like, wait a second, I have something here, and people are resonating with it in a way that is beyond what I expected, or it's unusual, or it's big. And when you know you have something big, suddenly spending money on it doesn't become a big deal anymore, because it's like, well, the market has spoken. Like they are telling me, you know, they want to connect with one another face to face, Facebook style, or whatever that business might be. You know, it's like, it's so instant. It's like people are into this, man. Like we need to be serious about this.
How do you get that feedback? I mean, in terms of game development or in your own personal work, do you send your work to people and ask them for feedback? Do you, you know, in gaming, do you do focus groups? Like, how do you get that effect? So that you, because I, for me, intuitively knowing I have so many ideas that I've very, and I, every idea I have is brilliant, by the way, and will make a billion rand. But the only thing is that, you know, you can't do every idea. So how do you get that feeling that this is the one? Is it through other people's feedback?
I mean, if we're going to talk about how to consistently have commercially viable video games and films and animated movies, well, then we're stepping into like formulaic territory. We're starting to go like, well, Hollywood likes this kind of movie. They don't like that kind of movie. The main reason being they're not going to invest $500 million in the next Marvel movie if it's going to be trash. So to avoid it being trash, we have to have these specific parameters around it, because we know that in the past, those have worked pretty well. And then they're happy to invest. Same as with video games. They'll look at something and they'll say, you know what, the first Assassin's Creed was great. We'll make the second one, but we need to make sure that it hits all of these new spots. We're going to advertise the technology. We're going to show off new gameplay. We're going to entice the audience in this way. And then we're going to, you know, put this much budget behind it and hope that it does well. That's one way of doing it. The other way that I've seen and have experienced for myself is a little bit more of like the mad genius type stuff. It's like when you are the first person to come to market with the first Witcher game, like CD Projekt Red or Cyberpunk 2077, those guys don't ask the market for permission. They do what they think is the coolest thing. And because it's run by creatives and people who really care about the product and the worlds, it can't help but be amazing. It's innovative. It's cutting edge. It's like Star Citizen. You know, it's completely different. It's a game changer. And when people are working on the cutting edge, I mean, look at Elon Musk, right? He's on the cutting edge of tech right now, right? So he doesn't ask people permission if something's going to be great, because he knows that no one's ever seen this before. No one's experienced this before. And so when you're at that level and you're willing to build stuff at that level, I think there's a natural part of the market that might react to it. But obviously, you need people behind you, right? In those cases, they had big teams, high talent, they spent the money, but the vision was clear. And there's something to that I haven't quite nailed down as a formula yet, but it fascinates me.
Minimum viable product again. Come back to the idea of show it to people, see how they respond to it. And it was what I did this kind of course on app development, and to go like, is there a need for this first of all? Are you super useful? All that stuff. So there's kind of criteria that you kind of hit on and stuff. But I think if we only see the successes, and a lot of these guys, I think the ducks, they look calm on the surface, but the feet are going crazy below the surface. And that is, and I think guys like Elon Musk and all those, they take those risks, and you just don't see you don't see it, but they're happy to take those risks because of the payoffs.
Yeah. Elon Musk has a crazy experience as well.
But they get this halo of success because the size of that success, or the risks that they've taken before. If you read Elon Musk's the articles on that stuff, he went bankrupt. Yeah, I think he went bankrupt with certain projects as well on the side. So I think that it's again coming back to that idea of like, is it risky or isn't it risky? Because what are the rewards to that?
Yeah.
And that winning halo is great.
And on a smaller scale than I made Tesla, is the halo of your portfolio and your resume, which is kind of like what you then leveraged into an art school, which you do have to have a halo of success in order to attract your own students. So just kind of like to lead into that then, you say concept art, visual development. Now, there's a lot of different kind of aspects of that I think people aren't generally aware of. I wasn't, but I know, for example, that there are artists who just make props in video games. You know, they make the urns that I ignore in Diablo 3. I'm the person who runs straight to the boss at the end and ignores everything. Like, then there's also scenic artists and character development artists and all that kind of thing. Like, is it quite a specialized job? Do you pick something, or do you play around within it? And what are the different job paths available to an artist?
Jeez, man, that it's so broad. It is really, really broad. If you're inclined to just say, for example, work in video games or work in film or animation, there is a host of specialized jobs you can get into. The smaller the company, the more you're likely to be required to be more of a generalist. So if you can code and you're a technical artist, in other words, you can put sets together, light them in the engine and all that stuff, and you're a programmer, like, your value just jumps through the roof. You can go work for an indie company and be basically the head of, you know, production, essentially. So that being said, what I do is in pre-production. It is the early stage ideas of, you know, creating art so that people have a vision to work towards. And typically speaking, if we're talking about, you know, job opportunities, there's so many. You get storyboard artists, you get concept artists, you get matte painters, you know, 3D artists, riggers, animators, texture, surfacing artists, you get lighters, lighting artists, or you get compositors. And every one of these jobs is a creative job, and they pay different salaries depending on, you know, the complexity of that job and how many hours it typically requires and things like that. So to get into the creative field in these worlds, it's not that hard if you pick one that is maybe in high demand. Yeah, in high demand and hard to bust into. Like, a great example would be like being a great compositor for VFX, right? There's not everybody's doing that, but the people who do it to a high level, they're indispensable, right? And there's like five of them on a team, and it's just bonkers. So yeah, there's so many jobs, and that's just, you know, video games. I mean, animation has cleanup artists. If you're talking about 2D, 3D, you've got like, you know, people who will sculpt specifically. They'll just come and sculpt characters so that other people get a vision of what's going on. And then people have to, you know, decimate those characters. In other words, break them down, break their polygons down in order to make them viable for parts of animation or whatever it might be. What's interesting is that all of these jobs are semi-fueled by the technology of the industry, meaning that, you know, technology is constantly evolving. If you look at films today, 3D films, for example, like 3D animated films, if you look at them today versus 10, 15 years ago, it's a completely different game. Like, we used to struggle. If you look at Toy Story 1, they would struggle to get things like hair, like, inside the film. So they would just block model it and just put a shader on it, and that'd be good enough. They'd call it a day. But today, everything can go hyper real. So we're at a point where technology was pushing towards real. Now we're at real. Where do we go from here? It's like, okay, well, then people don't want real because real is jarring. So let's take it a step back and do something fresh. So we're in a hyper-creative state right now where technology is facilitating more and more people getting into the industry. And there's more jobs now than ever in terms of specialization. But that being said, again, technology can do the opposite. I've seen recently with the new Unreal Engine, for example, for video games, that we no longer care about poly count in video games, not as much as before. So we can sculpt something that's like millions of polys, millions and trillions of polys in ZBrush and just import it straight into the game engine and run it, and it's fine. Like, there's algorithms now that handle that. So it's essentially taken a job out of the industry. The people who used to clean up models, they're gone, right? They have to do something else now.
Interesting.
That's kind of crazy.
You must kind of, and of course the goal of any company who's making these games is to make as many of those jobs redundant as possible. Like, anytime they can have an algorithm do the job instead of the artist, they'll do it.
Yeah, there is something a little bit gross about the bigger companies trying to require artists to do more and more in terms of skill and ability, because they want one artist to do as many things as possible. And it is such a maddening exercise because they're shooting themselves in the foot, because no single person can learn three different skill sets and be required to use them. And if that position opens up and someone can do it, that person will fill it and it'll be like the only person filling it. And that person might not be good at the one thing, you know? So it's a bit of a trend right now. It's a bit of the sort of abuses of power, like how much can we get for the money we spend in order to have higher profits. But I personally believe it's going to take a step back because more and more people are getting more specialized in one skill set and getting really good at it.
Technology tends to democratize things. It tends to make to even the playing fields on when it comes to skill level, and the people with the actual with the talent or the passion for it kind of jump out to the top. And the people who can kind of critically solve problems on the fly. So we saw it like when we used to hire as well. We spoke about the unicorns, the art director that can write and then can edit and then can photograph and then can do all those
things. Do a bit of web development. Yes,
do a bit of coding. No, you probably do like crappy coding in comparison to everything else. But they were the like you. And the problem is that there are those people out there, but I mean, it is the unicorns because they're rare. In the world of software, the full stack developers, they're hard to find. It's a weird thing, but you still want good people. As an example, the most the most creative problem solvers versus are you. Adapt at whatever software, because that software can change, can adapt. Like you said, the 3D engines are now so advanced that you just became redundant if you weren't the person adding something creative or adding value to that system.
Yeah. And that creativity is ramping up. It's good.
What the democratization does do, though, is it gives, like, for example, I edit stuff on Canva, which is like Photoshop for morons, basically. But I know. But
I use it.
For the moron I am, I can create something relatively good using templates and the stock photography that's available and the font combinations that I offer you and all that kind of thing, which means that there's people like Lucas and you in terms of art who are exceptionally high skilled, and then there's total morons who are mediocre skilled, which makes it more difficult to separate the people who are – it used to be people who could do it and people who couldn't do it. Like – if you were a typesetter, no one else can typeset, you know? So, like, if there was a very stark definition, whereas you can have a lot of bullshitters now who are like, oh, no, I'm a designer. Like, I design on Canva, and I can do it. It's mediocre, but there's this huge population of them now. And there's, of course, a huge population of concept artists on all the ArtStation, all the various kind of, like, platforms that allow anyone to upload whatever it is that they've been making. So finding those diamonds becomes harder.
Yeah, but there's still what's awesome about this industry that there isn't a software that can go and illustrate it right now. There are character builders, there are things, there are packs that you can do, but it's not from scratch or original or anything, because if one person can do it, everybody's going to do it. If your Canva flyer post, whatever, everybody's Canva flyers and posts look like that with variations on that theme.
So that's true, but it's a big world.
Like, think about the gaming industry. It has to be outrageous. It has to be crazy. And it's funny that the templates just don't do that. There's very little at the moment as it stands. I'm waiting for AI to come up with good fight.
I knew we were going there.
I might be proven wrong, but I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I think the thing, I don't know, like, correct me if I'm wrong, Gabs, but I feel like that for every Clash of Titans, for every Boot Fighter, there's got to be 1,000 mediocre games that look like they were developed by, like, with the same look and feel, like, that don't have.
Oh yeah, I mean the clones alone in the marketplace are just ridiculous. I mean, even for something like League of Legends, they've got like 10,000 clones, right? So it's really interesting. The people I interview around the world are really interesting as well, because they give me insights into things I don't get exposed to. For example, I interviewed this incredible artist in China. In Hong Kong, and I asked him, you know, what do you like about working there and what don't you like about working there? One of the things he said he hated was that so far China hasn't been able to produce anything unique. Like, they've just been essentially creating clones of everything. So you're in a sort of factory type situation where you're just creating factory clones of things that are never as good as the original. And he hated that. And to speak back to the whole AI thing, because I knew we were going there, I did another interview with a buddy of mine, Luke, who I worked with at Tasty Poison. He's now working in England. And we talked about, you know, will robots replace us? And I think almost every great talk goes to this point of, like, you know, you can imagine, like, Joe Rogan talking about this, right? Like, are robots coming, you know, like, smoke some weed. It's a really interesting conversation, because then craftsmanship becomes the thing we talk about. And, like, what is craftsmanship and how do we value it? And even though you and I both use Canva, John, like, we probably use it differently in terms of, like, our taste.
Oh, we, right? Definitely, so that, use it differently.
Yeah. And so that then becomes the factor that separates us as a brand. So even though Canva is a tool, we're using it differently. And then on top of that, what are we doing that's different from other people? We're spending 40 hours to create a page. Does that make it a better page or does it make a worse page? And then the whole is it art thing comes into play. So when I was chatting to my buddy Luke, he was like talking about, we got into the conversation of how the Japanese understand this, right? The Japanese have this incredible society where they understand that if you make something really well, you don't have to improve it that much. You just have to make it really, really well and just keep upping the ante of how well you can make it, that extra 1%. Like, it's not broken. You don't have to fix it. Just improve it by 1%, 2%, 3%. And at the end of the day, you walk away with this incredible quality. And for a very short time, my wife started working for Lexus, the brand. And Lexus is a sort of sub-brand of Toyota. And what happened was Lexus realized that they could compete in a luxury car market slightly differently from everyone else by leveraging this kind of stuff from the Japanese craftsmen. So they would go and embroider these incredible, like, seats into their cars that no one else in the world can do. And they just get these craftspeople to come in and do these luxury seats. And it sort of harkens back a little bit to, like, the Lamborghinis, the Ferraris, the custom-made stuff. They even have, like, types of paint that you can't get anywhere in the world. It has to be mixed very specially. So, like, the more that technology increases and the more we all start to compete at the same level, there are going to be those people who are just like, oh, we're just going that extra mile. We're going to roast our coffee, like, 10 more percent, you know, whatever it is. So, yeah, I think there's a huge amount of individuality coming through the creative spheres in the future in this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
That story made me so happy now.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Jaguar and the E-Type specifically. And if you look at, they make those things by hand. You know, they don't give them away. You pay for that. And there's still people doing it. They're still making, like, if you look at the special edition James Bond Aston Martin that came out, they make those so things cool. Every part by hand. And people are so more cool. than willing and lining up on waiting lists to pay that money for
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
And so that story just makes me so happy.
Wasn't it the Chimi Choo shoes brand that did something similar? I think it was them or some other shoe brand where they set up a shop and they basically said, you can come in here and you can buy any of these shoes over here, but there's that one shoe on the shelf over there that's just for display. And then people would ask about it and why they couldn't buy it. And it was like, oh, because it's already been pre-bought by someone because it's custom. And so everybody wanted a custom shoe after that. So, like, it's like this custom world that we're moving into. And we can see it in our everyday now, right? It's like, especially now that we have COVID, the options have increased more and more. Like I don't have to go to the shops anymore. I can have someone deliver my food here, and I can choose between like 10 different people to deliver my vegetables, right? That's amazing. And it's sort of an interesting part of where we're moving forward. I don't think we're moving backwards. We're moving forward into more options, not less.
So moving on. In March 2019, 1on1artschool.com launched, according to your LinkedIn. So what made you take the decision to open a school?
Okay, so truth time. It didn't start in 2019. That's actually when I registered the company and put up the website. And I did a terrible launch because I was even more of a terrible business person at that time. So it actually started before that when I was already working at Triggerfish. I got hired in as a production designer on a feature film that was an animated feature set here in Cape Town. And when I was working on that film in-house, I had to look after a bunch of new interns and a bunch of junior artists who were reporting to their leads, but primarily to me as the art director. And what I noticed was what I've noticed every single time I've been in a studio, there's always been these interns who come in and they just lack the fundamentals. Like they're just lacking the skills to actually compete with the mid-weight artists in the studio. And they have to probably sit in that studio as juniors or interns for like a good 2 or 3 years before they catch up. And the problem with that is it's unnecessary. They could have done that homework had someone taught it to them. So in 2018, I started experimenting with a 4-week mentorship for these juniors and for anyone who would be interested. And I said, hey, if you guys are interested, I'm going to put together a 4-week program to teach you the bare minimum of what you should know before you come in here. And so I ran that as my MVP, even without knowing that it was an MVP, just purely out of I want to help these people and see what comes out of it. And by the way, I enjoy teaching. So that was that side of it too. And what I did is I went onto Twitch a few times and I started doing drawing demos and stuff, and people were watching and they asked me questions and I said, hey, why don't you try out the 4 weeks? And so they did. And then a few of them would say, hey, this is really cool. Is there any more? And then whenever I finished with someone in the studio, they'd say, this was rad. Is there anything else I can learn? And I was quickly realizing, like, hold on a second. I'm teaching these people what they would learn at an expensive elite school overseas and pay an absolute fortune for. And I taught it to myself because I was in the gravity chamber, don't forget. So am I sitting on something that is viable? Became the question. And I spoke to my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, and I said, listen, I've just been doing this thing on the side. I'm being paid handsomely in the studio, but if this is an opportunity, like I should build it on the side and do a side hustle. And so that's where it became a side hustle, and now it's my full-time, right? So the side hustle completely transitioned me away from the industry I was working in primarily, even though I do touch it every now and then. Like I think this year, beginning of the first quarter, I'll still be working on stuff for, I think it's going to be Netflix. I'm not sure. Probably Disney or Netflix, one of the two. But I've stepped away because the product has, I basically went into the chamber again, but for my company this time. So I took what was a 4-week mentorship, I expanded it to 8 weeks. The 8 weeks went well. People wanted even more. And then I was like, okay, I'm sitting on something people want. And when you're in that situation, like I was trying to describe earlier, there's a moment where you realize like it's kind of hard to fail in a way. Because like if you just keep building it and they keep coming and they want it, then just give it to them, right? So that was my thinking. So I didn't think long term. Like I didn't think about, you know, how to run a business or what the best process was. All I knew was I need to turn this into something that is viable for at least a year. And that became my sort of guiding force for the next year and a half after that. So I basically finished up with Trigger, had the 8-week mentorship dusted and done. It was being taught live. It wasn't actually pre-recorded or in a program or with accountability systems or any of that delicious stuff I have today. It was really in its rawest format, which was me preaching it live and then asking people for homework. So it was really raw, but I had the program down. So then my wife and I went to Japan, where I proposed to her. And then when I got back, I basically decided to take this seriously. I had a plan. I put it together. I sat down and I said, how can I plan out, like, what is it? 66 more weeks of content right? And then I have to go back and finish the 8 weeks that I started and actually build that into content as well. So I was building the whole year's content in what I thought would be a shortish turnaround. And I had no idea how long building content would take me because I had to do the recordings, the editing, the voiceovers, the graphics, the showing up with the highest quality that I could, and making sure that everything was being taught in the right order. You know, all of the things that I'm sure teachers go through when they're putting together a syllabus for their kids, right? So I had to learn a lot on the job, on the fly. But basically, the whole way this worked is I just sat down with it and I planned it out and then I just started executing. And the only way I was able to do that was by creating like an Excel document and just having everything listed out and then putting dates to it and just giving myself deadlines. And that was actually the hardest part of it because, and if I may go on, is that okay? Are you guys cool with me to go on? Awesome. Okay, so what I did is I put it down and I basically challenged myself to go from A to Z, but I would keep myself motivated by crossing them out and like graying them out and creating drop downs that would say it's complete. Basically, all the triggers to create positive dopamine in my head that I'm actually completing something, right? Because otherwise, yeah, totally. And if I didn't do that, it would just be this ethereal thing. And that was actually part of the challenge for that year and a half of building content is like you're in the bunker. You don't know if this Frankenstein that you're putting together is going to come out and help the world and be a success. I wasn't even thinking about customers at that time. I was so self-absorbed into the product itself that I was like, I just want the best product. And I want it to be the thing that challenges the guys who are at the most elite schools who are charging now what is over R500,000 for a year's of education. Like I want that level of education, but online for a fraction of the price for people. And I want to get as close to that as possible. And that's still my goal. I still try to get as close to that as possible every single day. I'm like hustling towards that. But that year and a half of being in the bunker is terrifying because you don't know. The moment you breathe, the moment you stick your head out the window to get some air, you realize what you're actually doing, which is spending a year and a half of your own income. And that is hard, man. Well, it sounds crazy, but like so quick backstory. My parents gave me sweet fuck all financial education. Okay. So I was pretty screwed at the beginning. Like I didn't know what I was doing. My first couple of jobs, I would just blow my paychecks on like frivolities, like liabilities, like everything you can imagine. And like I didn't know what I was doing. And then it suddenly occurred to me, like, I need to adult the hell up, right? To actually figure this out. And so I started saving money at that stage and started putting it into investment kind of stuff that would just generate a little bit of income over time. And I would take, you know, jobs for the next 10 years, right, to start putting a little bit of money away. And during that time, paying rent and doing all the things that everybody else does and just trying to accumulate some kind of nest egg that I thought would be a long-term nest egg. But now in that year and a half, I spent like half of it on developing the product and going to market and building the company and registering and all of the stuff that you can imagine, right? And so in that time, that bunker time, it's the hardest time as an entrepreneur. I call myself an entrepreneur, but I'm a fledgling business owner. I have yet to start second companies, but like this is something that I realized while doing it was absolutely terrifying. There were really dark moments. We can get into that later if you like. But there were moments where I was like, okay, this is viable. This can go to market. Let me just keep going and have faith because I believed in it and I still believe in it. I think it's an amazing product and it's very unique because no one, to my knowledge, has built something so comprehensive coming from one person. Usually what happens is they leverage a team of people to put something like this together.
What a fantastic system. So, and it's also a system based on experience and trying to get that experience across to someone else in a digital format. Now, my girlfriend is a lecturer at the Stellenbosch Design Academy. So again, in COVID, everything had to be forced. So students now had to figure out online systems to teach kids and teach people highly skilled design processes and then critique those and give them back and feedback systems and then marketing systems and all those things. And all this happened in a matter of weeks in order to do that. And you had the luxury, I think, from, again, the timing wise, and I'm not sure, like, I can only imagine because in this time people were looking for new skills. Again, the silver lining on this, I'm sitting at home and I might be without a job. Now there's more affordable ways to do this. And it's, I think there's a lot of stars that align in a good and bad way for you. But it's this, I'm going to compliment you again. I think this is a fantastic system. And this, the backstory is, again, like, I love the Kung Fu analogy of learning, and wait for the perfect moment, and it happens, but there is no perfect moment. There's another thing that I wanted to kind of touch on with that. In the intro, we spoke about this, is the idea of entrepreneurs. And entrepreneurs, I think, always lack, and I see it in myself as well, is that I lack the business savvy side of it. I understand tactics and strategies and stuff like that, but not necessarily the formulas involved in that. Now, I just want to quickly, Ravi, interrupt you, but there's this book called the Visual MBA.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it.
This guy did this a similar thing where he went, like, I'm a graphic designer, illustrator, and I did my MBA, and I can make it this, I can get this information distilled in an information. So I thought, when I started reading this, I started snapping it for certain business principles, business fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
Just putting that out there. If you've
yeah,
read
no,
it,
it's a yeah, great, right. no, it's a great book. Good. Yeah. It's good.
Okay, we'll put that in the show notes, guys. Visual MBA.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely. So it's funny you mentioned that, because I'm busy. I'm actually working with a business coach at the moment. And one of the things we're building is we're going to go to market with my program in a big way this year. And we're going to be running a bunch of ads and all that stuff, driving people to it. But the point I want to make here is that as part of that offering, I'm actually building extra content on top of what I've already built. And I'm doing it right now. And one of the things I'm giving to art students is the stuff that I never had as an art student. And I think very few artists have. So I'm including a presentation on financial education for artists. It's for artists, but it's actually for everybody. And it's everything I've learned in the time. I've been looking at this stuff for like 10 years. So, cause I've been interested for about that long. So I have built this wealth of knowledge that isn't art related that I'm actually bringing back into the course, which is very personal, right? So that's a part of it. And I'm also doing career guidance in terms of like, how do you escalate your career once you're in? Like, okay, first you break in. That's the big thing, right? But then once you're in, it's like, okay, well, how do I become a midweight? How do I become a lead? How long does that take? How do I go from lead to art director? Like, what does art director look like? Should I even take that job? What other options do I have when I get to that point of my career? Well, it's like, okay, well, then you can go independent. You can start your own Kickstarter. You can do this. You can do that. You can start your own business like I have. Like, this journey is one that I think a lot of youngsters don't see. In fact, there's a lot of blindness. And I'm trying to connect students right now to the reality of the industry. And there's a disconnect right now, and I'm trying to bridge that gap. Partly, I'm doing that through my interviews with other artists who talk about it. But the other side of it is I'm actually showing up for my students. So when they come on board with me, like, I'm educating them as much as possible in other avenues that aren't art-related.
Amazing. So just to clarify on your actual teaching model then, you have pre-recorded content videos that people watch. Then they get, out of the end of that video, they get like a project or homework, as it were. They send it to you and you give them, you've record yourself giving them feedback, yeah? Or is it a live call?
Generally, do the elevator pitch quickly.
Okay, so generally speaking, that's exactly how it works. The only difference is, it's pre-recorded feedback most of the time. That being said, they still have access to me to one-on-one, that's the name of the school, right? One-on-one feedback, they can call me anytime that I'm awake. They can have access to me during the week. So we have calls just like this on Zoom or Discord or wherever we want to have the call that's most convenient for them. And they can actually, we can sit down with a problem that they can't solve and that I can't give them enough feedback on. So that's generally in the most extreme cases. But what I've noticed, especially with working with overseas, let's call them clients, but students, is that because our time zones are different, I've got, students in Australia, I've got students in America, I've got, some in Europe, like, and locally as well. It's like, in order to give them profound feedback, it's like they submit during their evening, I get it in my morning, I send them feedback, they get it when they wake up. So it's like the pre-recorded thing works much more effectively, but if they want that call, we make time for it at the extremes of our time zones, right, in order to make it work. And it works quite effectively. The system is just like that. You get the demos, you watch them, you get the PDF that has all the assignments. It's very structured in terms of telling them this is the expected amount of time this should take you. It says like from Monday to end of day Tuesday, you should have this done. And that's a time estimation I give them for them to stay on track, because I'm constantly trying to keep them accountable and trying to keep them on track. And the other system I have in place is once they've joined a specific term, or once they've graduated to a specific term, they get a new term tracker, which is like an Excel document where they get to see every single assignment, what status that assignment is on, and like how much feedback they've received on it, and whether or not it's complete or work in progress. And so we start to tick it off like that. Now, here's the interesting part. My school is unique in terms of the way we structure our learning system. We're not a university. We're not academics. So what we do is we don't progress you until you've actually conquered the technique that I've shown you. Because in reality, you want to leave working with me and be able to apply everything you do in the real world and not struggle. Whereas I find you can go to university, study art or 3D, and you will be passed just because you completed the assignment. It doesn't matter grades. It doesn't matter whatever. If you completed it, they'll pass you and say, hey, that's good enough. But the moment you hit industry, industry has high standards. And they go, no, thanks. We're not interested in your work. You're trash.
Can I touch on that as well? So I'm old school. I guess I'm a little bit old school. I graduated 2003, going through AAA advertising school was hard. There wasn't that much accreditation. It was a difficult course. You failed so easily because the standard was so incredibly high. We had it easier than 5 years before us, and then 5 years before them, they were the hardest every time. As it progressed, when it came to accreditation, I find it strange that accreditation actually makes the quality of the education less, as far as I can tell. The pass rate got lower as you go through the education system, where and the skills drop because you don't have to do that well. Look, I'm in my top 50%. That's not bad, right? No, it's terrible. You have to actually be maintaining a certain standard. Now, when it comes to accreditation, like you said, like the 500,000 rand courses to run overseas compared to yours, if the skill level is the same, the only thing now is this piece of paper. What is the value of that piece of paper?
Well, in my industry, pieces of paper, unless you need a visa, are completely useless. So no one cares about your accreditation. They only care about your skill. And your skill is demonstrated through your portfolio most of the time.
Or you live and die by your portfolio. Yeah. That's literally, I think I need to have that tattooed on my chest. it's and that's what people don't realize is that it's the presentation of that portfolio. It's the way that, because it's literally the proof in the pudding on everything. Yeah. Even though like clients would come to you and go like, it's not exactly the stuff, but the craft and the level of dedication that sits there, that is it. That is all you need. And I think there's a lot of freedom in that realization.
Yeah.
But with that comes education when it comes to parents. Now, what's nice about your model is that it's people that I want you to better themselves. So it's not necessarily parent dependent. Where parents would still go, it's so weird. Like it took a while to get people to understand the value of a degree. So then all of a sudden that PR, universities had fantastic advertising with PR.
Yeah.
We came to, you got to have a degree because the better jobs and all that stuff. Yeah. And it was kind of like this snooty kind of look down at people who were artists, artisans, welders, boilermakers, plumbers, all those things that like these people are now, they're the only people that have stable jobs. So if you have a craft, it is the value sits differently. So there's an education job that needs to happen to students and to parents in order to open that.
Absolutely. And one of the things I am extremely adamant about at my school, it's in every aspect of what I do, is the utter failure of student debt around the world. Like, it's so unacceptable. Like, you shouldn't have to pay a fortune for your education. It's so mad. Like, why should you walk away with such extreme debt that you only pay it off in like 10 years because you have a kid and a house and a mortgage and all these things? Like, it's gross. It's so gross. And it's not necessary. It's only greed. And if you're a rocket scientist or a doctor or a hardcore lawyer, then that piece of paper tells people that you put the time in to know your shit, right? So I accept that. But everything outside of that, I'm a little iffy on. Like any of the arts, like you better be showing up with high skill. Like I just think that's the best way to go. Especially like you were saying, it's so crazy. Like do you guys know, I think what's his name, Mike Rowe? He was the Dirty Jobs guy on TV. Well, he basically has come forward and said the same thing. And he said like, there is no reason to say to kids like, being a plumber or being a bricklayer or whatever it might be is a bad job. You can be a multimillionaire doing that. like, you need to recheck everything. Like, your everything you've been told, everything you've been brought up to believe about, like, what is viable in the market, it's changing. Like, we're stepping back into, like, artisanal territory now. And this is happening globally. This is happening in every country. I by the way, just a side note here. One of the things I do is I try to reach out to young students who I think are at a level where they could, like, you know, enter my school or consider it. And I talk to them. I just start conversations around the world with these kids. And I ask them, what's your education like? Where did you go? How much did you spend? Like, I ask them really deep questions about that, because I want to know what I want to have my finger on the pulse of the rest of the world. Like, what are they doing? And that's my way of doing it. And now that we have the internet, you know, we can do that. It's so cool. And the stories that come out are nuts. Like, I hear horror stories of people blowing so much money, or like entire universities being closed down because of lawsuits, because they promised jobs, like intense stuff. And I'm often shocked by the amount of money people are spending. Like, I speak to people in Spain and they're like, oh yeah, we dropped like a casual 200, you know, 1,000 euro education. I'm like, geez, man, what are you doing? Like, you're wasting your time and your money. It's mad.
It's insurance sales talk. It's fear-based as it stands. That's how I sum it up. It's like people, it's the same thing. Parents buy new prams, new cots, or when their baby comes out, because only the best will do for my kid. You know, like, and that's that mentality that sits as well. As like, I need to get the best insurance and all that, which yeah. is fair. And that's a psychological button to push. But within advertising and marketing, that's all it is. It's just a very kind of low hanging fruit. Whereas what you're talking about is democratization, freedom, financial freedom. You can do this from anywhere in the world. So it's a re-education job, but not necessarily on the negatives. It's not because those varsities are cut. It's just because they're expensive. And you do the same thing.
There's competition such a, now.
Yes, exactly. And I hope that these guys rethink, and I think they are. Like, if you think about a school like Bishops, and even on just a basic schooling level, are you Bishops online now? Because then I'm not sure why I'm paying for so much. You know what I'm saying? And I'm happy to pay you for your name. I've got, like, my kids going to Bishops, but the online version, which is education. Education, yeah. Whatever sticks in the brain, sticks in the brain.
You got to be hitting that branding super hard.
Like a lot of people go Stanford, Oxford, all those guys are online now. There are courses you can run.
Oh my God. I have to share it. Sorry to interrupt, but I have to share this crazy story. I watched, do you guys know Steve-O from Jackass? Okay. So I've been watching his YouTube channel, and I encourage you to watch it. It's very exciting. He talked about his early career where he became a clown. Turns out that in America, you have a higher chance of entering Harvard than you do becoming a clown. Like, just to point, like, to go back to like this whole thing of like, what is harder to get into or whatever, right? Like, it's so nuts.
So I've got a friend that I think she does occupational therapy now. She's a trained clown, and it was a hard, it's a training thing to try and do it. It's the mentality. People are seeing those gaps because everything else is full. We can't all be lawyers. We can't all be accountants. First of all, you don't want to be a lawyer because that's going to be taken over by AI, probably one of the first jobs. The next thing is an accountant. Okay, cool. You're counting other people's money. And then the next thing is the dentist. Oh my God, you're probably blowing your brains out.
That escalated.
I meant to do it in the higher things. I was being very nice to accountants. Again, in the chaos, there are opportunities, and people are finding new ways of expressing themselves and new ways of making money.
So in this chaos, in the pandemic, since March 2019, how did that affect One-on-One Article?
Oh, man, So I want to say it affected us in that a few students peaced out. One was legit. One was a young lady in Texas who was working a job, very physical job, and she injured herself and she wasn't able to carry on with the job. And then she wanted to do the school with me. So she did the 30-day free thing. And then she was like, you know what? I have to go back to work. Like, my family's struggling, whatever it might be. So she's like, I can't do this for a while. So she went back to work and peaced out. Another guy in England, similar story, bartending, you know, kind of. You, by the way, you won't believe how many of my students are doing part-time while working with me. It's pretty interesting. And so this guy was also like, oh no, the COVID pandemic. There's a lot of fear-based stuff around money and not being sure. But you know what? Like, at the end of the day, as much as I say that, like, I have to own that as a business. Like, I have to say someone stepped away from me because I didn't show them enough value. Because if the value was clear and the price was right, they would have been my client, right? So that being said, like, I take it personally from the point of view of like, what can I improve on, but not to the point of like, okay, you know, COVID is a terrible thing. That being said, I have not seen people overly complaining about it. And because people are at home more, they're more invested in spending time learning at home. And so, like, everybody's doing e-learning right now, there has been a boom, and I have been, I hope, blessed by it. It's hard to notice when people come to me for legitimate reasons. They don't say, oh, I'm here because of COVID. They come here and they say, I want to train with you because you're good and because what you teach is what I want. So it's hard to answer that question. But yeah, in general, I think it's been good for anyone who's doing online. And I'll tell you another small thing, which is people who are concept artists right now, they're in a really good place because where they couldn't work before remotely, now they're allowed to be. They've been given the trust to work remotely. And I don't think we're going to go back. I think now that we've opened the Pandora's box of this opportunity and the comfortability of working remotely and people can be trusted with NDAs, people are going to be more relaxed around it in future. They'll still want people in-house for security, but they're more relaxed hiring freelancers, which is super positive.
You can probably be pretty sure that anyone approaches you for training, I mean, although you do have kind of like a free course, like, they would be going to like an online learning platform or to YouTube if they weren't that serious about it. If they were just doing it because of the pandemic, I'd go and look up a bunch of YouTube tutorials and, you know, do those. So, what's interesting about your model as well is that because you're using pre-made learning materials and because you're recording your feedback in your own time, it scales much more than a normal teaching situation, which can only scale by adding more students, which eventually reduces quality. So, I mean, how many students can you handle at a time, do you find? And do you eventually intend to expand that by getting another instructor? Or how will you scale up, or will you ever?
I 100% will. For me, the quality is really important and the outcome is really important for my students. I'm personally invested in that because they deserve it, like, quite honestly. You shouldn't be buying education that gives you crap results, like, period. So I would say my ultimate goal is to have 96 students a year for myself. The moment I hit the struggle point, I will replace myself with someone else or bring someone else in to help me. Like, that is a reality. But as the business is right now, because I'm expanding this year, because I'm growing in completely crazy ways, I'm bringing new people in, I'm bringing professionals in, I have to pay them, I have to pay my business costs, I have to pay my business coach, like, all these things, like, I have to have an influx soon, right, in order for the business to continue to operate at its capacity, or I have to scale back. One of those two things is going to happen a little bit. So this year is really interesting. This is like the year where the school can really start to develop its own voice, its own feet. You know, it's really becoming an entity now. It's had a little bit of that time to start being a thing. I think with about 4, 5, 6 years behind me, once this gets going, like, that's when I feel like the school will have its own personality. Right now, it's an early development. It's like it's not even a toddler, right? We don't even see its personality yet. And it's there in my mind and in my heart and what I want to do, but it's not there yet completely. And it's being developed as we speak. So that's my plan for, you know, will I replace myself? Yes, I will at some point.
96 is quite a random number. Where do you get that?
I crunched numbers in terms of my goals. So my first goal was to get 6, which I've done. And my next goal is 12, which I'm working towards. I mean, this is full-time students, not part-time students. So full-time students is, because every time I hit that milestone, it's just a cash injection that I can do bigger things with the school. So then it goes to 24, because that's twice what 12 is. And then 24 becomes, you know, whatever, 56. 48. Or 48, yeah, and sorry. And then, like, it carries on until, you know, it gets to 96. And that's a nice round number for me to say. I think at 96, I won't have any personal time left. Right? That was right. In my head, I was just like, 96 students would mean I never see my wife and I'm too busy to do anything with my life. But at the same time, the school will be pretty huge at that point and I can start making bigger decisions. So that's my goal. I think it's quite audacious at this stage, considering the price point of the course, but it can happen, and I'm pushing towards it.
I got to say, dude, I really, admire the mindset you've got and the planning that I know that you've been kind of developing as you go along. But for me, it sounds like you're like making super smart decisions, that your structure is well thought out and it's got scalability, and you can easily bring in another artist as long as you vet the hell out of that person work ethic, mm-hmm. for quality of portfolio. There's no reason right now, as you say, the personality of One-on-One Art School is you, but it's not tied to you. It doesn't have to be you. It's just that I think your pillars are education should be accessible and good. And this is a industry level education that you're going to have if you want to get work. And the real test is do you get work? And there are lots of schools that promise that. Like, I think it was Red and Yellow as an advertising school, always prided itself on, you know, we're going to place you with an agency, you're going to get work out of us and all that kind of thing. But increasingly, those schools can't promise that anymore. It's a false promise for a lot of people paying a shit ton of money for a degree or a diploma.
To their credit, they promise you get an intern, and then they go, our employment record is. So you get an internship.
Exactly. It's like the COVID numbers. Did he cough? Did he die? It was COVID.
You could get to do the company Christmas card, and then after that, they don't know what the hell to do with you.
That was one of the. So John's making a self-referential.
It was literally me.
Story there. He did that. And I remember seeing the. You were at Saatchi's at the time. And the headline of the mailer or the directing or whatever it was, we don't trust our actual people to work on the Christmas stuff, but we don't mind giving them, or you actually wrote it from the perspective of, I'm an intern, they wouldn't trust me with actual campaigns.
Yeah.
They just trust me with Christmas card.
Yeah. Merry Christmas from the people they trust to do this kind of work.
That's great.
Cool, man. Yeah, so I guess the last thing that I've got on my list here is that at the end of 2020, you posted kind of like a little roundup of the year, and you said that you were surprised that you're more capable of running your own business than you thought you would be. And I think you've already talked a little bit about like that you did have to train yourself to run your own business. For those who you're in the world of art here, but for freelancers who are our audience, like, what do you suggest in terms of like, what should they focus on if they want to start their own, not necessarily school, but a hustle? Like, what are the key things that lead to success?
Interesting. I actually was looking around now because I want to find something that is definitely somewhere here. Just give me one sec. I want to grab it so I can give a visual example.
Sure. We'll do elevator music. Do. Do 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 harmonize do 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 do. Come on, man!
This is nonsense. Be a professional. Just
that could have been a moment, dude. That could have been content. That could have been content.
Make small talk. Shush, shush, shush.
And he's naked, ladies and gentlemen. So I wanted to show you guys a habit that formed so many years ago, and that is getting one of these. This is just a humble notebook. If you open it up, I got it from like some cheap store. It has this kind of paper, which is super blank, right? And then in it, I just take notes of everything I do. So this is like every book I read, I take notes, right? And I keep it as a journal of not just what I'm learning, but also as I'm learning from reading and taking notes in my daily life, I'll even use my phone and take notes on my phone. So basically what I'm doing is I'm constantly recording ideas, and those ideas often feed back into my business. So a lot of the things that I built into the school and into the systems came from that. It came from like, oh, why don't other people do this thing? Wouldn't that help students more? So then I would do it. And so it's like the micro ideas become macro ideas. And in fact, when I was early on planning how the structure of the course would go, I thought, what would be the best ways of marketing? What would be the best ways of doing this? And I would just come up with like visual ideas of what people should look at, how they should interpret it, things like that. So for me, journaling in this way, like purposeful journaling as you learn, is really important. I would say also just like constantly investing in yourself is a huge aspect of growing a business or growing anything you do, a side hustle. Because like you're only, the best quote I heard this week was, you are your business. Meaning if your house is cluttery, your business is going to be cluttery. If you're like excessively drinking, your business will be drunk, right? Like, so like you need to take care of yourself in a huge way because it will reflect your business. Your business is a reflection of you. So if you're looking at your phone 24/7 and you're playing video games, well, guess what? Your business is not going to take off. Like, it's just, I'm sorry. Like, it's just the reality of it. Like, if you want to be playing at a higher level, that's what you got to do. You got to make those sacrifices. So it's way easier said than done, but I find that through abstinence, it's a lot easier. I will, when I know I have to work on something, I'll just delete everything. I'll ban myself from certain apps. I'll take off all notifications. Like that helps me focus. And then you can see behind me, there's that calendar. I got like a whiteboard calendar, and I keep like all my notes on there for what I have to do every single day for like a month. And I update that. I have the journal has like the real deal of what I'm doing the whole year, but that's like the month, right? So there's not a day I wake up and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't have responsibilities. Like, I know exactly what I'm doing. I know from like 8 to 11, I'm with my students. I know from 11 to 12, I'm with Triggerfish. I know from, you know, I time box a little bit as well. So there's that. But
Is that out of necessity or was it something that you could do?
It is a little bit out of necessity, because if you don't do that, then what you don't plan runs your life, right? You will do other things that you don't want to do. Like, you'll browse Instagram for 3 hours. Like, you know, that's not helping your business at all. But like, reading a book is way more productive than that. So rather just time block something like that, right? So like, I've cut down, for instance, like Netflix in the evening to like one episode. Like, I used to like binge three, you know? So I'm just like one episode and then I need to go read or do something productive, like be a good husband. So yeah. There's that. In terms of, could you ask me the question again, John? I want to see if I missed anything.
It was just like, if for someone thinking about making the leap into starting their own hustle. So right now your advice is journal all your thoughts and the ideas will come, which I totally get.
Awesome. Yeah. So I think two more things there. One is have savings to work on a business, because you're going to need it. If you're going to truly do your own thing, I believe that you should focus on it. My wife tried to do her own thing while still doing a full-time job, and she soon realized it doesn't work. And I kind of agree. I don't think you should be doing two big things at once. Like, if you've got something going and you believe in it, try your best to step away and really, if you have to sink your own capital or take a loan, think about it. Like, really mull that over and ask yourself if it's worth it, because that'll tell you how serious you are about like jumping in with both feet. And I think once you are in with both feet, it's a lot easier to hold yourself accountable, because when you see your own money disappearing every month, it's terrifying. It will terrify you into action. And that is a good thing. Pain is a good thing. The other thing I will say is something I learned when I was producing content was I would get really exhausted from producing content every single day for weeks for a whole year and a half. So one thing I learned to do eventually was to take Fridays off. So I picked a day, I chose Friday, and I would take Friday off and I would just go sit in Exclusive Books and I would read books and I would just inspire myself and journal. And that's really where the bigger journal habit came from. And by doing that, I got to step away from my work and I got to have, let's call it a 3-day weekend, but also I got to have time for myself. And when you're so busy with your own hustle, you forget that you need to have that thinking time. And a lot of the guys who I respect and look up to, they make time to think. And it's really, really serious thinking. It's like, hey, I'm going to close my door now. When my door's closed, you don't come in here for 4 hours because I'm thinking, right? And it's super underestimated. Like, I think the school would not be where it is today had I not stopped long enough to really ponder about what it could be and internalize it on my side.
From a advice point of view, the productive off downtime. Fantastic advice. I tend to find I find that I sometimes sit just before I go to bed and I sit and think about stuff, and then you kind of get lazy and you don't want to write it down. It's like you sit there, oh, okay, I've worked it out. It's in my head. Write it down. Because you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, I would be there and I'd be like reading a book like this, right? And then as I'm reading, the guy in the book says something that sparks something in me and I'd be like, oh, crap. And I'd have to put this away, open the journal and just like, there it is. Get it down. And then I'd be like, okay, let me get back to reading. Right. And by the way, the other aspect of why that is so good is the physical removal of yourself from your working environment. As a solopreneur or a side hustle guy, if you're working from home, even from COVID times or whatever, you need to step away from your workplace. Cause like the toxicity of what I'm doing right now is that everything I'm building is in my own home. This is my living room. Right. So I don't have work separation. So that's dangerous for me. So I have to physically separate myself from this environment to do higher thinking and things like that.
explain the toxicity?
Well, the toxicity is there's no boundaries, right? Like, where is your home? Where is your work? Like, we're so used to going to offices that it's been drilled into us from like an industrial revolution perspective, right? Like, I should be at work, or like, you know, like I could have PJ bottoms on right now, right? And you guys wouldn't know, or no pants, right? And like,
sure. I'm a big subscriber to the no pants meetings.
Yeah. Mm. Is it going on right now?
You will never know. Or do you
know? It's also something that having a child has definitely highlighted for me, is that, I mean, I can hear him. He's doing this weird squeaky wail right now. I hope you guys can't hear it. But you can. Crap. Well, it's completely highlighted to me that, like, I can't work effectively. I can't be in the gravity chamber when he's here, because that sound derails my brain. Like, when your baby's crying, you can't think.
Yeah,
and you can't close your door. Like, there's no sound-canceling headphones strong enough to shut that out. So that's why I've kind of, like, in the back of my head, I'm going like, geez, I wish I actually had a shared workspace. If it wasn't for the pandemic, I'd be at a coffee shop for 4 hours on a Friday just so that I could, you know, and obviously not put him in the middle of the garden and walk away. Like, he'd be taken care of. But yeah, I do feel like a need for separation between, I've got an office and it's not actually enough separation from home.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think at the same time, it's a timing thing until your, the thing is, what's interesting about what, John, what you're doing as an example, the hustle, your hustle suits you. This podcast suits you. You can do it from where you are. And it doesn't, these things don't have to be super clean or super anything. Maybe in the background adds personality. You're hustling, you're doing your thing, you're building your empire. And part of it is, look, I've got a kid. There's this kind of pretense that that life doesn't exist. Now, to your point of the toxicity, that's a matter of perspective again. It's like Jeff Bezos does the whole things that they never stop. They work for 24 hours. The driven people don't stop. They work from home. They work from an office. But they figure out within their lifestyles how that can work, and it is completely imbalanced. But the rewards are completely imbalanced as well. So there is this kind of, we are very hard on ourselves and it needs to be balanced. And it's like, not if there's a difference. What's that thing about it? There's a job and a career. A job, you watch the clock, and a career, there's not enough time in the day.
Oh, yeah.
So absolutely. It's that approach to life. Super proud of you for working out of your living room and building this thing from your living room. People should wear that about with pride. Versus like, I have to try and find a separation. Kind of why? You need to separate time, not necessarily environment. But it depends on everybody else. Like, John's going off now to go and check on Ben.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, this working from home thing and what I'm doing, the side hustle, because I know you guys speak about this on your podcast a lot. So I do want to talk a little bit about it. Ultimately, I started the school not just because, you know, it was something that people were reacting to, but on a deeper level, I feel like one of my highest values is independent freedom, right? I love freedom the most. It is my highest value. If someone tells me what to do, I don't like people telling me what to do. I get angry when people tell me what to do, right? So I don't know what that is. Like, people, I've read up, like, maybe it's because I'm an Aries, or because like I'm a type of person that doesn't respond to authority because I'm my own authority, but I don't like it. So freedom for me is the reason I'm doing most of this. And I want freedom for myself, and I encourage it for my students. So I'm saying like, hey, you guys go work for those big studios, but don't forget one day you can have your own empire. You can have your own thing. Think about it in the meantime. While you're working for other people, think about your side hustle. Think about what brings you joy. Think about what brings you more freedom. Because like, even with COVID, most of us are realizing how much more freedom we have now. I think it's going to be super hard for people to go back to a normal 9-to-5 in an office when they realize they were doing it remotely and pretty happy for it. So I hope that my school, like, I will never take my school to a point where I lose that freedom for myself. In fact, I'll replace myself in order to keep my freedom level, because I want to operate from up here. I don't want to operate in the trenches. I don't want to be always with the soldiers. I want to be like telling my generals and stuff what to do, right? Eventually at some point, because to me, that operation, I can see the horizon. I need to see the horizon when I'm working. For me, like, if I could pick this computer up right now and take it with me and just fly overseas and do what I'm doing over there, I want that freedom. I want the freedom to say, like, I can get in my car and go if I want to, right? And that to me is really important, and it makes me happy, right? And at the end of the day, like, I say to people, you know, who I work with, like, what are your values in a specific area? And often during the interviews I give with my students, I ask them, like, where do you want to work and why? Like, what do you want for yourself? And a lot of the time it's like, man, I hate living with my parents, or like, I want to get away or do this or that. And I'm like, great, then let's work towards you getting what you want. And there are ways of doing that.
You're like one step away of being some kind of cult leader starting your own thing. It's like,
no, because then I would have asked you for a sacrifice.
you're still paying for the service. So that's your tenth that you're paying within your cult. The next thing is like, just listen to me. I can help you, really. Like, and then you're already working on your scriptures.
It's a triangle.
You're working on your own version of it. So, because you got your scriptures, but it comes via email and via PDFs. So you're pretty close. And the way you speak is very motivating. You're speaking in that kind of like, yeah, of course. What are your values? Do you want freedom? Of course, we all want freedom. Like, do you have a minute to talk about freedom? Because I can talk to you about freedom. You know, like, it's nice. I think it's
something that cult leaders and teachers have in common.
Teachers, yes. Teachers is negotiation.
Exactly.
Good job.
Dude, on that, I think bring it slightly to a close there. That was like really amazing conversation. And I just want to give you a spot here, like, to talk about your thing. You know, like, where can our audience find you? How can they find out more about what you're up to? Do you have any asks for them?
Awesome. Yeah. So obviously, if any of you guys out there who are listening to this know someone or are in fact interested in working in entertainment as a 2D artist, whether it's concept art or illustration or maybe something else, definitely come check it out. You can come to my website. It's quite easy. www.oneononeartschool.com. The ones are the actual number.
It's not easy at all. Explain it.
Yeah. So it's one as in the number, on one, the number, artschool.com. And if you go there,
let's make a bigger deal about this. It's the numeral on one. The numeral.
Yeah.
One on one.
I'm just going to write it on my
No hyphens.
In blood.
It's not a video. You went to go fetch that journal, by the way, to show it to a podcast audience.
It's actually the Black Bible. It's not just a journal. So yeah, that's where you guys can find me. So on the website itself, you can also click on resources. In there, you'll find a bunch of free resources like videos, on, you know, best practices, or all of my social media. So you can go check out my YouTube channel where I interview international and local artists, what they're up to, how they broke into the big game companies, stuff like that, their journeys, very similar to what we're doing here, but obviously from their perspective. There's that. And then obviously this year there'll be a few new things coming to YouTube. There'll be big expansions on the school itself. The program's expanding. I'm also launching the second year, which is a portfolio builder. In that, we basically take you through a hardcore mentorship program where it's just like me with you for a year, and we drill you into getting like ridiculously cool portfolio pieces out so that you can go get that job you really want.
Great. Well, best of luck for 2021. Thank you for taking the time.
You know, I have one more note, which is it's so nice to be interviewed instead of interviewing other people.
Yeah, it's great because you don't have to prepare. You can just show up and say stuff in response. Yeah, totally. It's cool.
Oh, you know your business, so those answers come easy.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier. Yeah. Cool. Thank you so much, guys. Best of luck. I look forward to keeping up with you guys and listening to your podcast.
Thanks, dude. We'll chat to you later.
All right.